all of the people who had developed the infections had consumed raw milk during the preceding several days before they got sick.
A foodborne illness is linked to raw milk on the Kenai Peninsula. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the tiniest catch, a day in the life of a small boat crab fisherman in the Bering Sea.
Literally zero. I pulled 10 blanks in a row, not even an immature or a female. Zero pots in a row yesterday, 10.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
A dozen states across the country have school voucher programs. Now, some legislators are trying to bring vouchers to Alaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that push for directing state funding to private schools has more momentum than it's had in the past.
On Wednesday, legislators packed one of the Capitol's biggest committee rooms to learn about some major ways Alaska's education system could be changed. You had the House Education Committee, the Senate Education Committee, House Judiciary, and Senate Judiciary, and then at least a couple of legislators who just wanted to observe. As Judiciary Chair John Coghill, a Republican from Fairbanks, noted, it wasn't ordinary to get so many legislators together to talk about a single issue.
This is an informational meeting and a little bit unusual in many respects.
School choice has been a phrase frequently tossed around the Capitol since the session started. More and more legislators have been pushing for Alaska to institute a voucher program, and efforts are being made to amend the state constitution to allow that to happen. Right now, the constitution expressly prohibits direct public funding of private religious schools. Wednesday's hearing brought together a group of voucher advocates to explain to Alaska's legislature how the law could be changed and why, in their opinion, it should be. None of the invited presenters opposed voucher programs. Many of the legislators in the audience seemed receptive to the idea of vouchers, asking about their mechanics and how they've worked in other states. But there were some concerns, too, even from legislators who had complimentary things to say about the idea of school choice. Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican, asked how implementing a voucher program would affect funding for traditional public schools.
We have limited funding as it is, and in a state that's funded 90% by oil revenues and in a decline mode, what would happen if you were able to allocate that individual resource to every family unit and allow them to vote with their feet if they voted to choose private schools in a way that allowed the public school system to deteriorate?
In response, Kevin Chavis, a voucher advocate and former Democratic Party politician, pointed to voucher programs in states like Minnesota, where public schools are still performing adequately.
It will help really put the external pressure on the system to do what they have been saying they want to do.
Much of the push for school vouchers has come from legislators representing South Central Alaska. Senator Mike Dunleavy, a Republican from Wasilla, introduced one of the resolutions that would get the constitutional amendment process rolling. And Representative Lynn Gaddis, a Wasilla Republican, has said that school choice is one of her priorities as education chair. At a press conference, Representative Laura Reinbold, a Republican from Eagle River, stressed that her constituents also want to send their kids to places other than traditional public schools.
They strongly support school choice, and so that's something I'm definitely going to be representing.
But not everyone in the legislature is pushing for education vouchers. Representative Bob Herron, a Democrat from Bethel who caucuses with the majority, expressed skepticism over the voucher program.
My constituents have grave concerns about that. And so I'm going to represent the people that elected me to office.
For the Constitution to be changed, an amendment resolution needs to get two-thirds of the vote in both chambers of the legislature. After that, the amendment would go to the ballot, where a majority of Alaskans would have to vote for it. A resolution to amend the Constitution has previously been introduced in the legislature, but it was never taken up by the Senate Education Committee. On Friday, the Senate voted not to refer the resolution to that same committee, which removes one roadblock for passage. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Since his election to the Alaska State Legislature last year, Senator Peter Michicki has found himself neck deep in oil and gas issues, something he knows about as a longtime employee of ConocoPhillips. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
Michicki says he does believe that the ACES oil tax restructuring bill that was passed in 2006 does need to be changed, but he does not support Governor Sean Parnell's bill to make a sweeping overhaul to the tax regime.
What's clear to me is that it needs a lot of work before I would support it. I don't believe that it has an adequate share for Alaskans. I don't believe that it has a guarantee designed into the bill that satisfies what I think Alaskans need.
Michicki says he likes the progressivity aspect of ACES that allows for a higher tax rate as oil prices increase, but he thinks the system needs to be adjusted. He says he will soon be meeting with Democrats, including Anchorage Representative Les Guerra, who have offered a proposal that is more of a modification than a complete overhaul.
I'm hoping that we can bring both parties together to come up with a solution that makes us more competitive but still protects the interests of Alaskans and delivers a few guarantees that any money that's reduced in taxes will be invested here and result in more production.
Since taking his seat in the Alaska Senate, Michicki has repeatedly faced questions about a potential conflict of interest when it comes to oil and gas issues, given his employment with ConocoPhillips as supervisor of the Kenai LNG plant. Michicki, who also works seasonally as a commercial fisherman, responds by pointing out that all of his fellow legislators have some kind of outside employment.
And I'm very careful, very cognizant of that relationship. But when issues come up with commercial fishing or residential rentals, which our family also does, or oil and gas issues, I'll analyze each of them. I'll check with ethics on whether or not they feel there's a conflict, and I'll declare it on the floor.
Michicki says he thinks there is a double standard at play when it comes to legislators who work in the oil and gas industry.
No one says a word when labor attorneys introduce legislation to do with labor issues. There's definitely strong feelings about the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska, and the second it pops up, suddenly it's a conflict when they ignore all the others. I'm not here representing an oil company. I'm here representing the people at District O, and that's the most important thing to me.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The State Department of Health is investigating an outbreak of a foodborne illness linked to raw milk. Officials have confirmed 4 cases of Campylobacter infection in people who drank raw milk on the Kenai Peninsula. The illness causes diarrhea, vomiting, and fever. Dr. Brian Yablon is a medical epidemiologist with the state. He says the cases have all been identified by a state lab in the last 3 weeks.
When they looked at these strains, they found that the 4 specimens all were exactly the same type. And so that is consistent with a cluster of illnesses. And when we found out additional information, it seemed that all of the people who had developed the infections had consumed raw milk or unpasteurized milk during the preceding several days before they got sick.
The state is still working to identify the source of the raw milk. A farmer named Kevin Byers in Kasilof distributes raw milk to families around the state. He did not agree to a recorded interview and says he doesn't know if his milk is responsible for the outbreak. He says his customers drink his milk for the perceived health benefits. According to a recent article in the Peninsula Clarion newspaper, Byers has 150 customers as far away as Sitka, and his business is growing rapidly. Selling raw milk is illegal in Alaska, but you can consume raw milk from your own cow, so farmers have found a way to distribute it. State veterinarian Bob Gerlach explains.
There are these share programs where people purchase a share or lease an animal, and because they're technically then a partial owner of the animal, then they can go ahead and consume the raw milk.
A similar outbreak of Campylobacter bacteria was traced to a Matsu Valley farmer in 2011. There were 18 people with probable or confirmed illness in that outbreak. That operation has since gone out of business. Gerlach says the state tries to get information to people who own shares of cows about the dangers of drinking raw milk, but he says it's difficult to track how many farmers are distributing raw milk in Alaska.
In most cases, somebody who does drink raw milk or is part of a cow share operation generally isn't communicating a lot with us because it's their own private business and they'd like to go ahead and keep it that way.
People with Campylobacter illness usually have a miserable few days and then get better, but it can be life-threatening in people with compromised immune systems. And Dr. Yablon says there are other risks.
At a minimum, it's a nuisance and it makes you feel pretty bad. But the illness can also be more protracted. It can last a week or longer. The bacteria actually could get into your bloodstream and that could cause major problems.
Yablon says in rare cases, it can also cause a type of arthritis or an inflammatory nerve disease. He says there is no scientific evidence that raw milk is any healthier than pasteurized milk. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management says it has found no misconduct in research by an Alaska scientist who wrote a 2006 paper on drowned polar bears and was subsequently investigated. Scientific Integrity Officer Bradley Blythe says in a memo to BOEM Director Tommy Boudreau that he considers the review of Charles Monet closed. Monet's peer-reviewed paper reported four dead polar bears floating in Arctic Ocean waters after a storm. Monet and a co-author suggested that polar bear drowning could increase if pack ice continued to diminish. The paper received widespread media coverage as a negative effect of global warming. Monet has been represented by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Executive Director Jeff Rook says the motivation for the investigation was retaliation by a pro-drilling federal agency. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the state sets a strict standard for the chemical sulfalane found in North Pole groundwater.
We've been working to try to come up with different cleanup options for this chemical that nobody has really had to deal with on this scale before.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The state has set a contamination threshold for sulfalane in North Pole groundwater. The standard reflects years of research on the chemical, which has polluted the aquifer in an area surrounding a local oil refinery. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Historic spills of the industrial solvent at the Flint Hills North Pole refinery have polluted hundreds of private wells off-site. The contamination was first detected in routine tests in 2009. State and federal environmental agencies have worked to understand the risk. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation environmental engineer Ann Ferris says a project team has determined a low-end contamination standard.
The final number is 14 parts per billion, or micrograms per liter, and it's a very low conservative number, so we do see concentrations higher than that, quite a bit higher than that on the refinery. Concentrations off the refinery have been anywhere from zero, actually, up to about 430 parts per billion.
Ferris says about 300 private wells in the area exceed the standard. Sulfalane is not a known carcinogen, but only limited research has been conducted, and people have been recommended not to consume the tainted water. Flint Hills provides affected property owners with water treatment systems, water tanks, or bottled water. Spokesman Jeff Cook says the company will provide water and maintain systems until well water tests below the contamination threshold. Meanwhile, Ferris says there's a continued focus on cleanup.
Sulfalane has provided a lot of challenges for us, so we've been working with Flint Hills and the University of Alaska to try to come up with different cleanup options for this chemical that nobody has really had to deal with on this scale before. But we're making progress. Flint Hills has upgraded their pump and treat system that's on the refinery, and that has been very reliable in the past year. And then additionally, we're looking at a technology called air sparging that seems real promising.
Air sparging involves drilling down to below the aquifer and pumping in high-pressure oxygen, which promotes the breakdown of sulfalane. Ferris says the technique is labor and cost intensive and not practical for the entire spill zone.
We're looking at a 3.5 mile long plume, 2 miles wide, and detections down to several hundred feet. So this is not something that we think is going to treat the entire plume, but the idea is to get at the higher concentrations, particularly on the refinery, cut off that migration from the refinery and clean up the source areas so that the rest of the aquifer can be taken care of naturally.
Ferris cautions the aeration technique could break down sulfalane into other dangerous chemicals, and testing continues. Flint Hills is covering the cost. The company is fighting with previous refinery owner Williams over who's responsible for sulfalane contamination, which stems from spills prior to 2000. Flint Hills bought the refinery in 2004. A hearing in the case is scheduled for April 8th. The DEC and other agencies involved in the sulfalane response host a public meeting in North Pole February 20th to update area residents on the contamination and cleanup. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The National Park Service is considering increasing winter vehicle access into Denali National Park. The agency is taking public comment on proposals to plowing farther out the road. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says access would be increased beyond the Mile 3 Visitor Center, where plowing currently stops.
The park road will be plowed to Mile 12, which is where we have the new Mountain Vista rest area that opened a couple of years ago. It has some great facilities, vault toilets, some picnic tables, and it affords a wonderful view of Mount McKinley if the clouds permit. And also it's a great jumping off spot for snowshoeing or cross-country skiing, getting into drainages. You can easily get over to the Savage River from there and points beyond.
Alternatives in an environmental assessment of the plan calls for plowing during the entire winter season or to begin in mid-January, or the Park Service's preferred alternative, mid-February. Pfister says the proposals reflect a general interest in increased winter access.
There always have been some comments about it. Well, it'd be nice if we could drive a little bit further into the road. The more recent impetus came from Fairbanks and from businesses who felt because of the increased winter tourism there that this could be a great opportunity for folks should they be able to travel further into the park.
Pfister says private and commercial vehicles would be able to drive the plowed portion of the road. She says in the early 1980s, the Park Service used to keep the road cleared to Mile 15. The deadline for comment on the environmental assessment is March 16th. Musher Rick Swenson, the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race's only five-time champion, has withdrawn from the 2013 race. The 61-year-old musher from Two Rivers has withdrawn from the race for personal reasons. Iditarod race director and race marshal Mark Nordman said Swenson informed him yesterday that he would not be on the trail this year in the 1,000-mile race from Anchorage to Nome. He says he expects Swenson to be back next year. Swenson has started the race 35 times and finished 33 of them. He won in 1977, 79, 81, 82, and 91.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ariel Van Cleve. This week on AK, the tiniest catch. They're often overshadowed by the larger Bering Sea fleets, but Unalaska has a handful of small boat commercial fishermen who make their living in the waters around the Aleutian Islands. During the recent Tanner crab fishery, KUCB's Stephanie Joyce headed out to see what it's like to be a small boat in big boat territory.
It's before dawn when the 42-foot Northern Light pulls out of the small boat harbor. At the helm, Roger Roland is tracing our path through the darkness with the help of a nautical chart loaded onto an old laptop.
I need the whole 10 hours to get through everything, so I have to start in the dark.
Roland has fished every Tanner crab season in the area since it reopened in 2002. Some years, he's the only boat fishing. But this year, there are 6 boats registered to fish 35,000 pounds of crab. For comparison, that amounts to less than a single delivery for one of the Bering Sea's big boats. And so far, this season isn't going well for Roland.
Literally zero. I pulled 10 blanks in a row, not even an immature or a female. 0 pots in a row yesterday, 10.
This day isn't starting much better. Even with the GPS coordinate for the first pot, we have a hard time finding it.
They're off our stern!
He kills the engines and rushes out on deck to help his nephew and deckhand, Caleb Roland. As Caleb stacks the rope coming over the side into coils on deck, I ask Roger what makes this different from working on a big boat.
This block would be spinning just... and the line would be going in the corners, and this pot would already be up from the time we got it. Full bore, everything, full bore.
At that moment, the 500-pound pot comes into sight and then quickly is in midair, swinging over the rail. The Rolands ease it onto the rack, then use the winch to pull the pot open, and then a handful of crabs spill out onto the deck.
5.5 inches. They have to be 5.5 inches.
The total count of legal males, 9. Nowhere near the dozens Roland is hoping for. Still, he's not discouraged.
Being dumb and persistent. So density and persistency will find the crab eventually.
We keep moving down the string without much better results. 5 here, 8 there. By the time we get to the 5th pot, we've brought up just 38 crab. Unlike the bigger fisheries, once Roland's crab is processed, it will end up being distributed to a few select customers or will be bundled into gift packs for the processors. For Roland, that's not an insult. In fact, it's a point of pride.
You'd be surprised how many big boat guys would love to do this. You know, a big boat's a ball and chain. You gotta feed the beast.
But our infinitely smaller beast still has an empty belly. So Roland sets a course for the outer reaches of Unalaska Bay, where he dropped a few prospecting pots the day before. In the more exposed waters, the Northern Light feels very small. We roll up and down in the 5-foot swells, trying to spot buoys over the crest of the waves. But the exposure pays off.
Whoa! We got crab! Woohoo! I thought it was acting heavy coming up on the swells.
How many do you think that is?
Oh, it should be over 50 keepers.
Suddenly, crab are flying everywhere, into the hold, over the side, occasionally straight at hovering seagulls. In the next hour, we pull in more than 200 crab. There are more pots nearby that could be full, but Roland decides to leave them and make a run across the open ocean to collect a bay. He wants to drop empty pots where he hears one guy made his whole season one year. That seems like a big gamble, but Roland says that's fishing.
I'm not just going to huddle here and save my fuel and hope I can find the crab. I'm going to run. And then if you fail, you've got to live with it. And I've had some failures. I've had some terrible failures. But you've got to risk the failure.
Roland spreads his risk around to several fisheries every year. In the summer, he's in Bristol Bay for salmon season and also long lines for halibut. In the winter, he fishes for Pacific cod. Between the 4 fisheries, he says he can normally absorb a bad season.
It evens out to a job. Good years and bad years. So I'm not necessarily doing it for the money because I'm not getting rich. I like this. I like breathing clean air, being outside, working hard.
Working hard is definitely the motto once we get to collect a bay. The fishery closes at 6 o'clock, so Roland has just 45 minutes to get his 8 pots in the water.
Hydros! Going over!
At 5:57, Caleb drops the last pot overboard. And that's it. We're done. With an empty deck and at least a few hundred crab in the hold, we chug toward town, one 42-foot boat length at a time. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're going to the Pribilof Island community of St. Paul, off the west coast of the state in the Bering Sea.
Hi, my name is Connie Newman, and I'm the superintendent for the Pribilof School District. Our district office is in St. Paul. District has St. Paul and St. George, and both communities are small, remote islands in the middle of the Bering Sea. They are referred to as the pearls of the Bering Sea. St. Paul has approximately 600 full-time residents, and St. George has about 65 year-round residents. We have an Alaskan corporation store, and it has everything. It's very well stocked, and they provide excellent service and a great variety of product. I know I moved up from a village in Southeast, and the village did not even have a store, so I really appreciate having that store. Of course, we have the Trident fish processing, and right now we're right in the middle of our king crab season. We also have APIA. They have medical facilities on both islands, and they bring in different folks throughout the year to provide service. The National Geographic beauty is especially striking. Coming from Southeast Alaska, which is, you know, very mountainous and heavily forested, you come to St. Paul and St. George, and you can see the striking cliff, the tremendous bird populations, wild marine mammals that live in the area during summer, and the beaches that they have surrounding the island. I know one thing that would really be a benefit is if we could have more reliable internet connection. Right now we have everything through Dish, and you know, depending on weather or the solar system, depends on how effective our connections can be. It's a great place to come and explore, and I would invite you to come to St. Paul and St. George, see the communities and visit with the local folks and check out the schools.
Connie Newman is superintendent of the school district for the Pribilof Islands of St. Paul and St. George. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Stephanie Joyce, Alex Duer, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ariel Van Cleef.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Ariel Van Cleef was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. What started as an idea in 1995 is now 1,000 strong. Learn more at ansep.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.